Well, we want to spend some time today with Neil Gershenfeld. He runs MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms and teaches the class how to make almost anything, out of which came a new idea. Individuals, using a kit he calls a fab lab, a handful of tools, including a 3D printer, computer-controlled lasers, and milling machines, to make whatever they want, maybe even someday, just like that Star Trek onboard replicator. The first fab lab was here in Boston. Now people around the world are using them. So what are the implications when people can make anything, maybe for a market of one? We want to learn more about what Neil calls the third digital revolution, the first being phone communication, the second, the internet, the third, digital fabrication, making things. Neil, Professor Gershenfeld, get us started. What do you mean?
So three is digital fabrication, and those words have two different meanings. The casual meaning is anybody can make anything. The casual meaning started in 1952. MIT was working on an early air defense computer called Project Whirlwind, and it was one of the first computers that could answer in real time. It used to be you would load cards into the computer and it'd go chunk, 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 and eventually you'd get an answer back. Uh-huh. But it didn't do it in your time. It did it in its time. And somebody had the idea of what if you connected the computer to a machine to make stuff. And at that time, the Air Force had some parts for airplanes that machinists couldn't make by hand by turning the cranks. And so Project Whirlwind was connected to a milling machine to turn the cranks and machine stuff.
There you go.
That was the first computer-controlled machining. Since then, it's proliferated. There are about 20 computer-controlled manufacturing processes. You can burn with lasers, you can cut with wires, you can use jets of high-powered water. And then starting around the 80s, people started depositing material instead of removing material. So you can print, fuse, extrude.
Let's explain that more. I mean, when you're using a laser to cut something in a factory, you're taking stuff away.
Right.
The transition was people adding materials, plastics and things, to build.
Right.
Take us back to this first class where mm-hmm. your students were making anything they wanted.
The first time I offered it, like hundreds showed up. It was just jammed. And then the students would say things like, this seems too useful. Can you teach this at MIT? They were there because they wanted to make stuff. So then they did semester projects. They were amazing. Kelly Dobson, who's now at RISD, made a device that saves up a scream, records it, and releases it later when it's convenient.
Wait. I could record a scream onto my iPhone and hit the button when I'm irritated at somebody. What was different?
This was well before iPhones existed.
Oh, okay.
But the form factor she made was a big backpack you wear in front with foams that deaden the acoustic sound and squeeze sensors. So it's the physical experience. You have this backpack in front you scream into and it completely deadens your sound. Saves it internally, and then you squeeze the backpack later and you kind of squeeze it and it comes out.
Okay.
Mi-Jin Yoon, who's now on the faculty at MIT, made a dress instrumented with sensors and spines. And when you came too close to her dress, the dress would defend her personal space.
And there was an alarm clock that you had to convince you were awake?
You had to wrestle with it, and then it would be convinced you're awake. A student leading into a fun topic made a web browser for parrots that lets parrots surf the internet.
Well, out of all of this, you realize that there's a certain amount of equipment that you need to make things. And you formed something called these fab labs, which have become places, but they begin as a kit.
Yeah, so let me now relate these. This happened so consistently year after year, I realized the students were answering a question I didn't ask, which is what is digital fabrication good for? And the answer, exactly like digital computing and communication, is personalization. So the point of personal fabrication isn't to make what you can buy in stores, because you can buy that in stores. It's to make what you can't buy in stores. It's personal expression in technology. One of these fab labs was about a $100,000 investment, about 10 $10,000 machines. It includes the 3D printer, but also all the other machines. And we set up just one with Mel King in South End Technology Center.
This is a community activist. But just to be clear, so you've got this $100,000 or so at that point kit of these machines, including a 3D printer, but also lasers and cutters. And you put this fab lab kit in an actual lab. And what did the kids there do?
Everything. So if you think about MIT and Kendall Square, people do research, they incubate businesses, they play, they make art, they make useful stuff for them. exactly all of that, just no difference whatsoever. The same curiosity, the same interest, the same mix of profiles, now just done in this community scale. It was in no way different from how the tools were being used on campus, sort of the same spirit and mix. So people made products they wanted, they incubated businesses, they taught classes, they played, they did art. And then in turn, the thing we didn't expect is then the lab started doubling. All over the world, we found people who got it but didn't have access to the tools. And so there's a few hundred of these now. They're above the Arctic Circle. They're in rural India and African villages.
Norway. What did they do with the lab in Norway?
So the first one in Norway is in one of my favorite places on Earth. It's in the Lingen Alps. It's a few hours above the Arctic Circle. It's so far north that satellite dishes look at the ground, not the sky. You have to look down to see the satellites. Sheep and reindeer would go into the mountain for a whole season, and they used to do nomadic herding, and things like national borders and land use have inhibited traditional nomadic herding. And so they started putting cell phones on sheep and reindeer to find them in the mountains. But the problem is there isn't good cell phone coverage in the Lingen Alps above the Arctic Circle. And so what they wanted was instrumented sheep and reindeer for nomadic herding, but they make the antennas and radios. And they were struggling with how to do that. And that was one project. Another project was finding roads after avalanches, a whole bunch of these locally appropriate things. Similar to that, one of the most saintly people I ever met was S.S. Kalbag in rural India. He set up a science school for dropouts in a poor, dry part of India. And they had a whole bunch of technical problems for agriculture, for healthcare, where they needed instrumentation and they couldn't get access to it. And he really beat into me. They actually know what they need to do. What they need is the technology to create technology. And that's what's really driven this viral spread.
Right. The Fab Labs allow them to fix their own problems. That's Neil Gershenfeld. He runs the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. He's written that he loved shop as a kid and wondered, why don't we have digital shop? So now his is called the Fab Lab. You can see a slideshow of it at hereandnow.org, where we also have a link to our interview with a fashion designer who made her own shoe with a 3D printer. Just ahead, what are the concerns, though, about digital fabrication? What does this mean for the business world? In 1 minute more with Neil Gershenfeld, our guy for all things future here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with MIT professor Neil Gershenfeld. We hope to visit frequently to hear about the digital future. But today we're talking digital fabrication, individuals making things with tools already on the market like MakerBot and Ultimaker, or Neil's Fab Labs. These are kits with several tools like 3D printers and laser cutters. Fab Labs are being used around the world. Neil says this is a moment akin to when the big mainframe computer makers dismissed personal computers, said they were just toys. That now manufacturers risk going the way of the mainframe if they also dismiss personal digital fabrication. There are problems, though, a cost, but also concern. The goal is to have machines replicate themselves to bring down costs, but what if they take over or fall in the wrong hands? And, Neil, let's start there. Now, you've said a 3D printer is just like a microwave. There was all this initial excitement about microwaves, but ultimately they're just a tool in the kitchen. Still, someone with a 3D printer made a gun.
A lot of the coverage of doing bad stuff with this is ill-informed. And I say that for a couple reasons. One is, in general, we find making weapons isn't a driving application because it's a well-met need. Just about anywhere in the world, it's not hard to get guns. You don't need to come to a fab lab for a gun. You can go to a street corner. And in the same sense, this thing about 3D printing is a very clever media hack, and I really respect it. But the reason it's a media hack is hobbyists have been able to make guns for a long time. Making guns in a little workshop isn't new. And in fact, a 3D printer is one of the worst ways to make guns. I think there's a great service in what you're doing to help understand what lies beyond the 3D printer.
Beyond that. Well, other concern, what does this do for business? You've already said that these are things that you're not going to go and get from a manufacturer. That's something you've dreamt up, like a clock that you have to wrestle to the ground to prove that you're awake. But what if that changes?
So here's the interesting implication for business. If you go back to digital music, digital software, each of those revolutions, they didn't eliminate the old industry. They severely disrupted them, but they created all kinds of new industries. And so in the same sense, mass manufacturing will still stay, but it'll by definition make the boring stuff because everybody gets the same thing. Just like tracks for your iPhone or apps for it, it'll create these whole new markets of buying and selling where you can design something locally, you send the data and produce it globally. A great window into that is colleagues in Barcelona. Wonderful city, beautiful design tradition, 50% youth unemployment. Economy's broken, a whole generation can't work. Yet ships come into the harbor with products made far away, they get used and trash goes in the landfill. So they're filling the city with fab labs. So that the city can be globally connected for knowledge, but self-sufficient locally, technically. You produce what you consume. It means instead of going to big box stores to shop for products, you produce products on demand. You could produce it. A neighbor could produce it. It could be designed locally. Somebody in Barcelona could design furniture for you that gets made locally. It delocalizes buying and selling from consumption.
Well, and that might be good for Barcelona if, in fact, with these fab labs all over the city, they can come up with ways for people to say, you know, I want a chair, but I want it to lean back like this. Or so they use the cutter and the graphic design, and they use all the equipment that's in the fab lab, and boom, they make their chair. But what about the company that made chairs and used to ship them to Barcelona?
Yep. So I've taken a number of companies through the parallel between, if you look at Route 128, Wang Prime, Data General,
Boston,
DEC,
yeah,
all these computer companies that were killed by the PC while calling it a toy,
yeah,
that script is repeating. The only company that survived from that era was IBM, and it survived by giving up on PCs and becoming a services business.
So you're saying that the companies that don't grasp this and adjust to this will be gone, just like the big mainframe companies are.
What we found is companies in certain industries that face problems so severe get it. Like the aerospace industry gets it, because what they have to make is so difficult, they're embracing it. But a lot of companies in the middle are behaving exactly like Wang and Prime and Data General, saying those are toys. And the mistake they're making is a PC can't do as much as a big computer, one, but a lot of PCs can. So in the same sense, one of these little fabrication facilities can't match a factory. But if everything you make is different, then it makes sense to put it on a desktop. And a lot of facilities doing low-rate production equals one facility doing high rate. And so that script is really repeating. We explain to the companies, here's the history, here's where you fit in, this is the script repeating, and they nod and then proceed to continue to do whatever they're doing. This is like the birth of the internet, but it's sort of literally an internet of things. It's an internet where data becomes things and things become data. And we're seeing the birth of entirely new businesses where you go to market by shipping data and you produce on demand where you consume.
Not just somebody in their basement with their fab lab. You have a lot of it in your basement. I happen to see it. But, for instance, your kids came up with a design for a game. Somebody in a fab lab produces it. So there's a path here for the entrepreneur as well.
Yeah, and in fact, when I was teaching my kids to use the first laser cutter we had at home, they loved the laser, but they thought the project was dumb. And so they invented a project you could do with it of how to assemble parts. And my research students were making these 3D assemblers with 3D parts. My at the time, 8-year-old kids, Grace and Eli, figured out how to make 3D structures with 2D parts. And now all of my grad students have switched to the design from the 8-year-old kids, and now a number of other grad students and research groups use that design. And so it's an example of the information flow started from off campus into the field, but now in many ways more information is coming in the opposite direction. What it leads to is you can really kind of, a place like MIT or Harvard are based on sort of a sense of scarcity. You have to come here to get access to it. Adding digital communication, computation, and fabrication really lets you kind of blow up and distribute advanced research and education. And for me, that's the ultimate implication.
To give it to someone else.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, get back from them their ideas. Well, my head's exploding. That's Neil Gershenfeld talking about the digital fabrication revolution, people being able to produce things they already are by themselves. Neil is a professor at MIT. He runs the Center for Bits and Atoms, teaches the class how to make almost, in parentheses, anything, and is behind fab labs springing up around the world. We'll link you to much more information at hereandnow.org. Neil, can't wait for the next topic. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So, we can now all say we went to MIT, at least for a few minutes. And by the way, we know the next topic. In the coming weeks, Neil will be back with musician Peter Gabriel to talk about their idea for an interspecies internet. Very cool. And we will be back with the latest news here and now.